Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V26 Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Visit Lowe's and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18. Lowe's knows you don't want to sacrifice reliability for savings. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select LG appliances and purchase two or three select major appliances to get an additional 10% off. Save big on LG, America's most reliable line of home appliances at Lowe's. Based on independent reliability surveys 2021 to 2024 and select major appliances as compared to competing manufacturers offering full appliance lines. See associate for more details. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Exclusions apply. Valid 6/18 through 7/9.
Hi, this is Jennifer Rubin, and this is Jennifer Rubin's Green Room. So happy to have you back. Where has the last couple of weeks left us, other than depressed, demoralized, scared? Listen, things are not well on the Democratic side of the election. We've had a president who performed not just abysmally, but really failed to respond to the concern, the legitimate concern, that people raised afterwards. And that, of course, has been, for me at least, more troubling than the debate performance itself. For whatever reason, he and his team have dug in. Rather than admit that the president is 82 years old and he doesn't keep the schedule a 40-year-old does, but nevertheless, he remains one of our best presidents, and on his worst possible day, could run circles around Donald Trump. Instead of doing that, instead of leveling with people, instead of acknowledging some physical limitations, the deny, deny, deny has, I think, had the opposite effect. And worse, not allowing him to get out there and do the kinds of events that would give people greater confidence has become a real problem. He should be doing town halls. He should be doing more interviews. He should be doing very long press conferences. And the nagging sense that many people have is, why isn't he doing this? Is it because he can't? Now, I want to separate two things. I think you can be a very good president, as he has been, put together an excellent team, make good decisions, insist upon the best information. You can do all that. You can run a White House and, frankly, run a country. And at the same time, not be on your toes verbally all of the time. At times, lose your train of thought. At times, show your age. These two things are not inconsistent. But I will be honest, in the eyes of the public during a campaign, good luck trying to separate those two things. So the president, for now, is going to try to do those things. He's going to try to say, I'm not a young man, but look at what I've done and look at the results. Okay, well, that's worth pursuing. But I think something else has to happen. If he wants to stay in this race, and for now it looks like he is, I think the calls for him to get out and step down have backfired spectacularly. If he wants to stay in the race, it has to be a different kind of race. And the good news is we have examples of how you do this. The French. Yes, the French. What did they do? They were up against the right-wing government of Marine Le Pen. And what did they do? They formed something called the New Popular Front. This was a hodgepodge of left-wing groups, of socialists, of far left, of green parties. And in addition, they had Macron's party, which is a center-left party. And what they did is they didn't run on the leader of the New Popular Front because, frankly, they didn't even know who that person would be. That's going to have to be thrashed out. They didn't run on this shiny new platform that the New Popular Front would put out there. They ran against fascism, and they won. They said, what these people are offering is a threat to the essence of our country, the essence of being French. It is a threat to liberty, equality, egalitarianism, and it is a mortal threat to our survival as a country, because these people will sell us down the drain to the Russians. These people will pit one another against each other. These people will alienate our democratic allies. These people will take us back to a dark episode in our history, and we cannot allow that. That's what they said. And they said it for a couple weeks, and it worked. And that's because they had truth on their side. They really were fighting a fascist threat, just as we are fighting a fascist threat. Now, we don't have Le Pen, we have Trump, but we have two other things which I think may help the cause of democracy. One is Project 2025, which you've heard me speak about. This is the fascist blueprint. This is the one that says, we're going to take away birth control. We're going to go after various segments of the federal government. We're going to replace 50,000 people with Trump cronies who are going to take an oath of office to him. Imagine that. We are going to roll back the separation of church and state. We are going to lose entire departments of government. We are going to run your life as a Christian fascist state. This is frightful stuff. It is a recipe for financial disaster. It's a recipe for social disaster. And it is creepy and it is weird, which is why the Republican National Committee is trying to draft something else, a platform that sounds less creepy than the real plan. And in addition to 2025, we have the Supreme Court, handpicked by Donald Trump, which has now invested the president with criminal immunity for everything that he can label an official act. Who would, in their right mind, give Donald Trump the presidency under those circumstances? Do we trust him not to go on a crime spree? He went on a crime spree last time. Now he has the knowledge that he has complete impunity. And since his underlings know that he has impunity and that he can pardon them, there's nothing to stop them from going along with his crackpot schemes. So I think we have the building blocks of a campaign, but it's not built around, frankly, this president. As good as he has been, as much progress as we have made, it is a campaign that has to be waged by democracy against fascism. It has to be run on the principle that if we allow Trump with this president, this plan, this Supreme Court back in power, America as we know it is going to really come to an end. We're going to be out of NATO. Russia is going to be at Western Europe's door because they will have gobbled up Ukraine and perhaps gone after the Baltic states. We have to be honest that this is a plan for economic ruin when you start rounding up millions of people, putting them in camps and getting ready to deport them. What do you think that's going to do to the economy? And what about the operation of government? Simply the impartial information that we depend upon to combat climate change, to keep our food and water safe, to keep hurricanes from wiping out communities, all of those things will be lost. So it's not the ideal situation, but it is a situation in which we can nevertheless prevail. So what does that mean for all of you? It means that you have to educate your neighbors, your friends, anyone within your social media platform about the dangers of Project 2025, about the dangers of this Supreme Court, and about what Donald Trump has in store. Do you want women nationwide to lose access to medical abortions or any abortions? Do we want the Comstock Act, this 19th century law that prevents people from sending abortion medication or abortion other materials through the mail? Do we want that to be the law of the land? Are we going back to the 19th century? That's how I think the most effective use of your time is now, is to publicize what Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans are all about. Because who's ever at the top of the Democratic ticket? It will probably be President Biden. It's not going to be about him. It's going to be about saving American democracy, saving functional government. If the French can do it, we can do it. And oh, by the way, in Britain, they weren't fighting fascism. They were fighting incompetent, grossly incompetent, mind-blowingly incompetent Tories. It wasn't that the Labour Party there was something so special. The new prime minister is so boring that he's been noted for making dullness his most distinguished feature. You don't have to have a positive, charismatic figure. It helps, but you don't have to. If you run against incompetency, cruelty, fascism, you might prevail, and we better do so. So don't give up hope. Keep working for democracy. Volunteer your time. Give to groups that are fighting for democracy, helping to get the word out about Project 2025 and the Supreme Court. And remember, it's a republic if we can keep it.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariana. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hey everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
We have an unusual show today. It's not about topical American politics or legal issues or even foreign policy. It's about an idea, and the idea is centrism. It comes together for me in the form of a book that I contributed to by the name of The Center Must Hold. It was put together by an Israeli, Yair Zevon, who happens to be the advisor to the opposition leader in Israel, Yair Lapid. And what he did is he went around the globe finding people to contribute chapters on aspects of centrism. What is it? How does it work? Why is it a good thing? How do you create it? And I think it's a fascinating look, not only at a phenomenon that I think has been badly misunderstood. It is not mushy compromise. But it's also so interesting because it comes from so many different places and so many different voices around the world. So there is something out there, if you will, in the water that is causing people to look at the polarized, angry societies in which we live, in which democracy has become rather dysfunctional in many instances, and look for a better way. Is there a philosophy? Is there a mechanism of government that allows people in a heterogeneous society to work out their differences, figure out how to get along with one another, and actually come up with policies that have greater staying power because there's a broad consensus behind them? That might seem like a pipe dream, but it is not. And I am so delighted to have on the show today, Yair Zevon, who is our intrepid leader, and also Malcolm Turnbull. Malcolm was the prime minister for quite a time in Australia. He led the center-right party, and he is now a prolific author, podcaster, and I'm delighted to have you both. Welcome, gentlemen. Yair Zevon, who joins us from Israel, tell us first a little bit about your background. You're Israeli, but you speak with a British accent. So how did you get to where you are?
Yes, and I'm speaking to you today from London. So I'm Israeli born, but I grew up in the UK. I spent 13 years living in a town called Leicester, which the sports fans will know. And then after graduating and working for a couple of years, I moved back to Israel, where I served in the army for a few years. I worked for Shimon Peres during his presidency, And for the last decade, I've been the senior advisor to Yair Lapid, who is former prime minister, foreign minister, finance minister, now leader of the opposition. And for our conversation, also the head of the largest centrist party in Israel.
Very good. And Malcolm Turnbull, you come to us from Australia. Where in Australia are you?
Well, I'm here in my office in Sydney. And yes, it's a lovely day. It's winter, of course, which is not very arduous by either American or Israeli standards.
Well, I suspect you may find a lot of inquiries from nervous Americans in the next few weeks or months. But let's dive right in to the book, The Center Must Hold. Yair is our leader in this endeavor. What gave you the idea to put such a book together?
So it's an idea that's been spinning around in my mind forever. And as Malcolm might know, sometimes political defeat drives action. And so actually the real spur for the book was after the 2022 elections in Israel, when the government that I worked in lost, and we were replaced by the government that Israel has today. And I was just deeply worried about the direction the country was going in, about the direction that politics was going in. And I've always been a centrist and always known that I was a centrist, and I was sure there were others out there. And so the idea was to try to get together a group of some of the people that I felt, I think, were some of the best voices for centrism across the world, to try to get them together in one place and try to put forward a coherent argument for what political centrism is and why we need it so desperately today in the face of populism, polarization, extremism. So that was the thinking behind it.
So give us a working definition of centrism. And I think the people who contributed to the book may have slightly different angles, but I think there's a lot of commonality amongst the contributors. How do you define it?
Sure. So I do think that one of the important things is there are a set of shared values, which all the contributors, I think, sign up to and agree to, whether that's a deep commitment to liberal democracy and the defense of liberal democracy, its culture and its institutions, whether that's a belief in equality of opportunity rather than necessarily equality of outcome, whether that's a liberal patriotism that I think we all aspire to and support. But I think that at the core of centrism is understanding that in a complicated world, solutions are complicated. And what we're trying to do is finding a balance to the tensions that exist in something as complicated as running a country. H.L. McKennan's got a great quote about how every complicated problem has a simple, clear answer, which is also wrong. So I think what we're trying to say is that the answers are complicated.
Yes. Malcolm, you successfully led a government, and you also had the benefit of certain institutions. We think of centrism as kind of this floating phenomenon, but in fact, there are mechanisms and solutions that can drive centrism and make it successful. And that, in large part, is what you write about in your contribution. Tell us a few of the mechanisms, which, oddly enough, are becoming more popular in the United States, perhaps having seen the Australian example.
Yeah, thanks, Jen, and congratulations, Yair, on bringing the book together. I'm really delighted to have been able to contribute a chapter. Look, institutions and rules matter. Democracies will prosper or not, in large part, depending on the way in which they're managed. In my view, and I think most people's, sensible people's views anyway, politics should be mediated at the centre because you want to bring people together. I mean, the whole idea of a parliament is to bring people together where they can compromise and talk and, you know, understand that they don't know they don't have a monopoly of wisdom themselves, and that their political rivals may have a point or two to make. And that spirit of compromise is actually, I mean, it's human. It's part of our natural instinct. That's how families mediate issues. It's how small communities mediate issues. So if you believe that the best form of resolving issues and working out how to form collective action is to come together at the center, you've got to have institutions that encourage that. Now, in Australia, we have three features to our parliamentary democracy, which we've had for around 100 years, in fact. So there's no one alive can take any credit for them. The first one is we have compulsory voting. So we estimate, and there's a small fine if you don't vote. So we estimate that 97% of Australians over the age of 18 are on the electoral roll, and they have a duty to be on the electoral roll. We know that about 93% of those enrolled voters vote at a parliamentary election. Australians like to vote. I had a totally voluntary plebiscite on legalising gay marriage at the end of 2017, and it was totally voluntary. 80% of the eligible electorate voted, and I might say about 62% voted yes. So that was a good outcome. So that's one, compulsory voting, and that's important because it means you don't have to rush off to the fringe to get your vote out. The second thing is we have what we call preferential voting. Americans would call ranked choice voting. I think in Britain, yeah, they call it the alternative vote, but it basically means that if you have if you have four or five candidates, you number each box one through four or five, and then if no candidate achieves an absolute majority on their first preference votes, then you eliminate the candidate with the lowest number of first preference votes and distribute his or her preferences until somebody has a majority. Now, what this means is that if a party goes off to the extreme, a centrist can come, or an independent can come through the centre. And that's exactly what's happened with my party, the Liberal Party, which is the centre-right party in Australia. After I was defenestrated in end of 2018 or August 2018, my party moved further to the right. As is typical, as we all know, your real enemies in politics are in your own side, not on the other side of the chamber. And so the right, became ascendant. And as a consequence of that, we had a number of what had been very safe, large L Liberal seats became, won by independents who came through the centre, who were all smaller Liberals, progressive on climate action, progressive on social issues, and women. That, you could see there was a sending a bit of a message to my party. So that's a second feature. And the third one is, of course, which quite a few countries have, we have a independent electoral commission that draws the boundaries of districts. So we don't have gerrymandering. And, if you look at an Australian electoral map, you'll see that the boundaries run along main roads, railway lines, riverbanks. They're designed to, make it easy for people to understand what electorate they're in. And of course, represent the right apportionment of voters. So all of that has tended to make our politics come to the centre. Although I should add, for Yair's benefit, we discussed this question a while ago with Theresa May, the former British PM, who's an old friend of mine. And we were discussing why Australian British politics were less extreme than the United States. And Theresa thought that it was largely because Australians and Brits were more sensible than Americans. But there may be a bit of truth in that, but as we congratulated ourselves on being more sensible, but I think the real reason is institutions.
What is dadication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariana. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dadication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
We record this at a time that Macron has suffered through election in which he, representing the center left, fared terribly, and the far right and the far left prevailed. In the United States, we have a contest between a center left party and a very extreme, actually authoritarian right wing party. And in Israel, you have a government that is a coalition government, but beholden to a what outsiders would call a religious extremist or a religiously driven party or parties. Why is this phenomenon so prevalent around the world? What is pushing from the center to the extremes? Whether it's Israel, whether it's America, whether it's France, whether it's some other European countries, which have also adopted very right-wing governments.
So the first thing I would say is I'd counter a little bit with a sense of a bit more hope about the picture. As I said at the beginning, I'm here in London. There's going to be an election as we're talking in a couple of days. And it looks like a centrist Labour Party is going to win that election relatively comfortably. And that is a Labour Party that dragged itself from the, I think, populist illiberal left into the political centre and is reaping the rewards of that. I think in Israel, if you look at any opinion poll today, if an election was held, the next government would be a predominantly centrist, centre-right, centre-left government. And that's where the Israeli public is overwhelmingly. And there are other examples as well, I think, worldwide, where the centre is actually doing pretty well. There are a few reasons that we're struggling. In particular places, and things that we could be doing better. One of those is, and this is an issue that I think dominates much of Western politics today, and that's how you deal with an issue like migration, how you connect to the genuine fears that people have and realize that those fears and that anger that people feel is genuine. And you have a responsibility as a centrist politician to connect to that in a real way and show real empathy and not dismiss it. Just because somebody votes for a candidate that you might find abhorrent or who you think is racist or anti-democratic doesn't mean we should dismiss all the people voting for them. And we actually need to find be better at connecting to people, working out why it is they feel that, which will open the door for us to offer what I think are more pragmatic solutions to complicated problems. I think the same conversation is true in lots of places around the fear that people have around technology and the pace of technological change. And so one of the things that centrists need to do better is to tap into those feelings, connect well with those genuine feelings that people have, and then make the case that the answer isn't going to come from populism. What we know about populism is it does very well at grabbing onto those issues, but when it has to actually provide solutions, it does very, very poorly. And so I think what the center has to do is grab onto those issues earlier and not let the populists fail. That's one of the big challenges. And the other one is in faced with a politics that's driven by fear and anger, we have to offer something different. And we shouldn't be afraid to offer a politics that is hopeful and positive and sets out a vision of what we believe the world can be and sets out a plan for how to get there. That's not a naive utopian future where everything's perfect, but it is a realistic, positive vision for our countries. And I think if we can do that better, that'll give us the tools to counter this kind of rise of populism and extremism that we're seeing. The really important thing, and you and I have spoken about this before, the answer to the rise of the illiberal right cannot come from the illiberal left and vice versa. The answer has to come from the center. The worst thing that can happen is for a country to be in a position where its only choice is two radicals on either side. So that's why the role that I think that centrists are playing or need to play is so important.
One of the aspects of centrism that I tend to latch on and I wrote about in my contribution is a certain attitude towards politics, as Malcolm said, the willingness to compromise. But it also requires a bit of humility, a bit of recognition that you don't have all the answers on your side, and that people that you disagree with vehemently may have a good idea now and then, and maybe combining ideas would make for a better outcome. Malcolm, does that phenomenon, can that kind of culture of compromise, of reasonability, of modesty in one's ambitions. Does that come from politics, or does that have to come from the culture around it?
I think it's both, because politics doesn't exist in a vacuum. One of the problems we face in Western democracies, and Jen, you're living with it in an acute, very acute form in the United States, is the way the media landscape has changed. You know, there used to be a time when we all watched more or less the same television stations, read the same newspapers, and while we didn't share the same opinions, we shared the same facts. We're now in a situation where we're dealing not so much with competing opinions, but competing realities. Now, countries which still have strong, for example, national broadcasters like the BBC or the ABC in Australia, do have that sort of solid glue, fact-based, you know, political glue in the middle, where at least, you know, hopefully the facts are being accurately, you know, portrayed. But you look at the United States, you look at what Rupert Murdoch has done there with Fox News. I mean, that diet of angertainment has had the consequence of making the United States more angry and divided than it's been at any time in its history since the Civil War. And it is a problem because people are living in their own silos. Now, you know, again, this is a fact of life in Australia too, but I think we've got a number of countervailing factors. But it's I think is part of it. I mean, I think it was often attributed to Winston Churchill and then Enoch Powell, but I think it was actually somebody else who said a politician who complains about the newspapers is like a mariner who complains about the sea. And it's right to this extent that is we are all in that environment. So, you know, politics doesn't end when you leave the chamber. It's not like a football match, you know, where the only people who participate are the players. We're all in it. And the environment has been dramatically changed by these changes in the media, which, of course, you are more familiar with than any of us.
I think, Jen, I'd add, if I can, one thing to what Malcolm said. Beyond, first of all, yes, I think cooperation in politics is important, and we have to show that it creates more sustainable policy, that humility that I can learn from the other side. If you bring more people together and build a broader consensus, your policies are more likely to be sustainable and longer lasting. And one of the facts of creating policy is that it takes time for it to have an impact. I think alongside the media landscape, which is clearly one of the challenges that we face, is also how do we create the social spaces where people still interact with each other. And some of those community organizations that we're used to, where people used to just meet and talk and spend time together, have disintegrated. And we need to find a way to rebuild that social space. And that's exactly what Malcolm was saying about how politics doesn't stop when you leave your parliament building. It's all the societal structures around it that we need to look at. And I think the more we have those sorts of areas and places where people can speak and talk, share ideas, and actually just have a drink together, even though they don't agree politically, the easier it becomes for politicians to compromise as well.
And there was a very well-known book in the United States by a gentleman by the name of Bob Putnam, who wrote a book, Bowling Alone. And that was, in fact, one of the phenomena he traced, that we have denuded our civic interaction, sports clubs, civic groups, philanthropic groups. And we now sit in our own homes on our own scrolling news feeds and get angry with one another. And we have to figure out how to bring people back into the public sphere. I want to focus, Zvon, on a phenomenon in Israel, which we might have to try out in the United States. And that was when the independence of the court was threatened by a proposal from the governing coalition. And people could read about all the details. I don't want to get distracted here. But what happened was really extraordinary in Israel, and I think to a degree we have never seen before. And that is a mass movement, peaceful, in the streets from very diverse sides of society, right, left, center, secular, religious, military, non-military, tech, traditional economy. How did that come about? And what is the lesson that perhaps we can transport before we get to a crisis point like an attack on the independence of the courts?
So I remember a conversation with a Turkish friend, a former member of parliament, who said that they woke up one morning and realized that they weren't really in a democracy anymore. And they said, don't miss the moment. Don't miss that moment that's happening. Now, in Israel, we were fortunate, I would say, that the justice minister laid out very early his entire plan for a judicial overhaul. And so there was no question about where we were headed. And that helped to motivate people. The reason the protests were a success, and this goes back to what I said at the beginning about centrism, the success of the protests, from my perspective, was when the protesters took to the streets with Israeli flags in their arms and wrapped around their shoulders. Because what the protesters said was, this is a patriotic protest. This is a protest to protect Israel as a liberal democracy, to protect the values of the country, to protect what we believe the country has been and should be. And so it wasn't a political protest against the other side. It was a protest for the country. And that created a very broad space that allowed lots of people to get involved. The other thing I would say is, because that sense of threat of how far this was going to go was so real, that it pushed people. And I think, and sometimes we hear this as a criticism, that centrism isn't passionate enough or radical enough, or doesn't go far enough. Well, you had avowed centrists like myself, who were willing to go out week after week after week and protest, and who were blocking streets in Israel and blocking main highways to say, we just won't let this happen. On the night that Netanyahu tried to fire Defense Minister Gallant, hundreds of thousands of Israelis took to the streets spontaneously and refused to leave all night until the trade union called a general strike and until he had to withdraw from the attempt to fire him and withdraw some of the legislation. So there was a passion and a willingness to fight for what we believe in that sometimes people say is missing from centrism. And when the threat was there, I actually think you saw a incredibly passionate centrist response to that threat. And that's why it allowed so many people to join, and I think why it was ultimately very successful.
And what was extraordinary about that, it was not only the way it came together, but it was about liberal democracy. You know, people march and protest all over the world because of fuel prices, because of wars, because of all sorts of issues. But they were protesting for a principle that is near and dear to liberal democracies, and I think to centrism as well, which is a limited government, a judicial independence, and a check on the will of the majority. Democracy does not mean a tyranny of the majority. So I think it was sort of an extraordinary moment for many, many reasons. And I'm trying to figure out how we do that now in the United States, frankly, because I think we've had that moment. We speak after our Supreme Court has just apparently invested our president with criminal immunity from most of everything he might try to do. So it's been a stunning week here in the United States. Malcolm, if you wanted to go to countries that have been torn asunder by polarization, extremism, fractured media, where do you begin to repair those ties? It seems like such a insoluble problem to kind of knit back together the institutions and the culture needed to kind of get back on track. Where do you start? How do you start?
Well, I think if we were to look at if we look at Israel, I'd have a single member constituency parliamentary democracy. I think electing all of the members of the Knesset at large is a sort of recipe for, I mean, it's as the Israel electoral system seems to be designed to create a fractured, parliament. I mean, you've got to actually, you know, institutions and rules matter. Just saying you have an election isn't enough. I think in the United States, I suspect Americans would never get comfortable with compulsory voting, but ranked choice voting would make a massive difference in your yes. country. I mean, if you take the example of Liz Cheney, if Liz Cheney had run in the general election in Wyoming on a preference, you know, with the old ranked choice, she would have won. The MAGA official Republican candidate wouldn't have achieved 50% on first preferences. She would have come second, I would say, and she would have won on Democrat preferences. And you see, if you look at both Alaska and Maine, where you do have ranked choice voting, your Republican elected officials, your elected representatives, are much more to the center of their, you know, of politics than the rest of the Republican delegation. So, you know, I think, I'm not saying Australians, again, we've had this for 100 years, right? So there is nobody alive, as I said, who can take any credit for it. But it is, I think it does keep your politics more to the center. I think that matters. I think the real, we do now have a real challenge with the media. One of the great American journalists, Emily Bazelon, wrote a few years ago in the New York Times Magazine that, you know, we defend, First Amendment rights and, you know, free speech on the basis that in the marketplace of ideas, the truth will prevail. But nonetheless, we are drowning in lies. Now, how do you rectify that without having, you know, without censorship, and which, you know, of course we all recoil from? I think a big part of it has got to be public broadcasting or media which is committed to telling the truth, getting the facts straight. And it's really hard. I mean, I used to be a journalist, you know, in my youth, which is a long time ago now. And it is very hard if you are in a partisan environment and, you know, your commercial, competitive, journalistic rivals are in the entertainment business, not to feel that you've got to balance it. And so, so holding the center, you know, this is, I mean, we're all, I mean, I think, I'm sure you are, and all of us are inspired by that, great poem of William Butler Yeats, where he talks about saying, you know, the center cannot hold, and, wider and wider in the circling gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer, things fall apart. The center cannot hold, but the best line is the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. I mean, these are lines that, you know, have been going around in my head for a long time as politics gets crazier. But I think it's hard. Look, Jen, I think truthfully, I cannot think of a country which has come back from this yet. It is hard. It needs very strong leadership. And part of the problem is that you get a tactic that Steve Bannon summed up pungently, if not eloquently, as flooding the zone with shit.
Yes.
And
yes.
you create so much disinformation and distrust that people don't believe anything. And therefore, when Donald Trump tells 100 lies a minute, people say, well, oh yeah, okay, but they all tell lies. You know, you can't believe anything. And that is terribly dangerous. I mean, I actually had a conversation with Trump, that notorious one, you remember, I think the Washington Post actually ultimately reported the transcript of the call, a redacted one, I'm glad to say. Where I was saying to Trump, you know, I expect the United States to honor the agreement we made with Obama. And Donald said, well, you know, you're a businessman, you must have reneged on deals in the past. And I said, no, well, that's not true. I've, you know, my reputation has always been to be a man of my word, you know, and I expect you to be too. Now, this is, you know, this is, so it's a question of values, you see.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
So in that conversation, did you feel like you were in outer space? I mean, I'm just thinking of the thought bubble above your head, because many of us did read about the actual verbiage. But what were you thinking while this was going on?
Well, I thought it wasn't surreal. I've dealt with a lot of big bullying, you know, billionaire personalities in my life, you know, whether it's, you know, Kerry Packer or Jimmy Goldsmith or Conrad Black or Bob Maxwell or, you know, Rupert Murdoch, although Rupert, while he's a bully, is not as, you know, flamboyant as the others, etc. And, you know, we all know them and they're a type. I thought Trump's incandescence was a little bit surprising and, of course, a bit menacing. But, you know, as I said, I mean, I've published an essay in Foreign Affairs about this just recently. The only way to deal with bullies in general and Trump in particular is to stand up to him. And, that's what the Israeli people did, when they came out into the streets and took on Netanyahu's attempts to, undermine the independence of the judiciary, as you just described, you know, with Israeli flags over their shoulders. So you can't, the only thing you get from bullies if you give in to them is more bullying.
Absolutely. As we reach the end of our time, I'll ask Yair this. Israel, as we speak, is engaged in a horrible war. But we have known since its founding, that Israel was dedicated to not complete compulsory military service. And in fact, there's a fight about that going on in Israel right now about the religious exemption. But the vast majority of Israelis serve in the military. We don't have the draft in the United States. And many people, including the late, great John McCain, advocated for some kind of national service. Despite all the divisions, despite all of the problems that Israeli politics face, does the military serve a purpose beyond national defense in terms of helping to knit the country together and providing one of those opportunities to confront people you would never meet, never see, and whose lives may be very different than your own?
Yes, is the short answer. I think it does. I think it puts you together with people who think very differently to you, who come from very different backgrounds, and puts you in a position where those things seem far less consequential than they do in day-to-day life. So there is definitely a value to it. And part of that, I think, also comes from the sense of crisis and emergency. I think although we have policy differences, Israelis, I think everybody in Israel wants to do everything we can to bring the hostages home. And I think everybody in Israel understands the threat that we're facing and the need to counter that threat. And so I think that sense of crisis also ends up uniting you in tragedy. And helping to overcome some of the divisions. Now, the political divisions haven't gone away. But one of the things you hear from people who serve in the front lines, from combat soldiers, is the way you talk about them changes because the situation that you're in gives you a different sense of perspective. It's not that people go into the army and come out having given up on their beliefs or feeling differently about whether it's judicial reform or religion and state or economic issues or whatever it might be. It's just that it gives you, an ability to speak to people who are different to you. And so if we were talking about some of those social structures that maybe don't exist, that's one of those social structures that certainly does exist. And so it definitely plays a value, definitely has a value in society.
So let me close with this, Yar. You had what I think was a brilliant concept. I don't know how difficult it was to round up and get all the cats in a row. The herding cats analogy, I think, was probably certainly the case. What has been the reception, the reaction to the book?
So the reaction so far has been incredibly positive. There's been real interest in it, which is obviously pleasing. But more than that, it's people who come up to you and say, I'm really glad that this exists now. And I feel that I can see myself in it, and it hasn't been there before. And so, you know, when you look at the scope of people who are in the book, obviously yourselves as two of the most prominent voices in it, former prime ministers, current serving ministers, from across the world, and people going to say, okay, wait, there is this thing, and now I can be a part of it. So the response has been really positive. And now the challenge is to get it out to as many people as possible and hopefully spark that debate and that conversation wherever we can.
Well, as I like to say, I consider myself a radical centrist, I aspire to be part of that club. Thank you both for joining us today for a great conversation. We will put a link to it's always Amazon in this country, the Amazon link where people can buy the book and also take a look, Malcolm, at the article you referenced, and if people are interested in getting a good look at Australian perspective. So
Jen. And I just might add, I do my own podcast series called Defending Democracy, which explores all of these issues. So we're all focused on it. If I could just make as a footnote, you mentioned Robert Putnam.
Yes.
And his book Bowling Alone. And he made the distinction there between bonding and bridging social capital. And, you know, bonding social capital is when people of a similar group, you know, so, you know, it might be a Jewish organization, a Catholic organization, you know, where people get together and create connections, but they all have something in common. Bridging social capital, which is what the army does, or perhaps what a surf club does in Australia, or a lot of service organisations do, is where you get people from all sorts of different backgrounds. And interestingly, what inspired Putnam was work he did in the 70s in Italy, where he sought to answer the question, why is the north of Italy different, you know, much more, you know, shows much more civil cohesion, for example, than the south? And one of the explanations he had was that there was more trust in the north, and that was in large part, he argued, because of the tradition of choirs, so that people would join a choir and you would have, you know, the local lawyer, the garbage collector, the, you know, cop, you know, the teacher, the, you know, baker, butcher, candlestick maker, etc., and everyone would be in that choir and they would get to know each other. Now, whether that's still the case, you know, 50 plus years later, I don't know, but it certainly, in my view, these forms of bridging social capital are terribly important, particularly in an environment where, you know, as I said, we're in the media, we're dealing not just with competing opinions, but competing realities.
Well, on that note, I encourage those who are listening to join a choir, join a civic organization.
I would empty the choir.
Yes.
People would flee.
To join a service organization, to get to know your fellow citizen, because
Good
we
idea.
Certainly are all in this together. Thank you, and I'll look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks, Yeah.
Thanks. And that was Yair Zivan and Malcolm Turnbull. I don't know about you, but I found the conversation fascinating. And I think because you have two people who are not Americans, who have recognized a phenomenon that we tend to think is a purely American problem. Polarization, radicalism, a media environment that creates havoc and fosters disinformation. And they come to tell us you're not alone, that this is a phenomenon around the world, and that there are democracies working at this, trying to solve the problem, and trying to get back to a philosophy that frankly governs our everyday lives. You do not take, if you are a member of a family, a club, a school, the most radical position that no one else agrees with and insist it be done your way. That only works in a totalitarian system. And most families are not exactly totalitarian structures, schools, organizations. You got to figure it out. You have to figure out how to live with one another. And what centrism does is, I think, first of all, give people a way out. In the United States, I am one of many who for a while found myself to be a political orphan. I ceased to be a Republican. I wasn't quite sure what the Democrats were all about. So I used various terms, independent, centrist, moderate Democrat. But what these all had in common, I soon discovered, was the desire, the hope that we could get back to a governing philosophy that produced good results, that did not thrive on conflict, anger, violence. And there was something that was very freeing about leaving one political party. I think it allowed me to, or accurately evaluate it, but also to look at the alternative and to see what elements within that party were productive, created good results. And it so happened to coincide with a period of time in which the Democrats had two rather extraordinary presidential campaigns, one successful, one not, where the leading Democrat was a centrist. And it struck me that for all of their faults, I am a Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden kind of Democrat. And that place on the political spectrum allows you, I hope, to appreciate that the far extremes of both parties are not competent and not a desirable way of organizing our lives. I personally don't want to live in a country in which Donald Trump comes anywhere near the levers of power, or even a Tom Cotton or a Ted Cruz. But neither do I think that we would hang together as a country and come up with great policy solutions if Bernie Sanders were the White House, and were in the White House. So there has to be a better way. And I think the book helps us think about that, gives you some role models for how that might work, and answers some questions. And I think as we look forward to this election, or dread this election, this could not come at a better time, because I think the task ahead, as Yair said, when the Israelis took to the streets to unify behind liberal democracy, small L, small D, liberal democracy, is what is needed in the United States. We need to prioritize our devotion to liberal democracy, our devotion to functional government, our devotion to the rule of law, no matter what the Supreme Court says. And we cannot afford to make this election about personalities. It must be about the values and the definition of America. So I'm very grateful to have been included in the book. And I had a lot of fun writing my contribution and reading others' contribution, people I greatly admire. So if you're inclined, look in the book in the show notes and you can get a link to purchase the book. In any case, if you enjoyed this program, you enjoy our other programs, please tell your friends and please tell me what you think. If you enjoyed the program, if you consider yourself a centrist, let me know. Let me know if you have other ideas about centrism and have idols who are centrists. We should celebrate them. We should talk about them. We should raise them up. So I'm interested to get your take on things as well. And as I always say, if you like the program and you like our other programs, please tell your friends. They can listen and follow at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, or wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.